Yeah, actually.
You know, the rectangular-ish tortoiseshell.
Well, good evening, everybody.
No.
Rick's running it.
Hello. Thanks for coming tonight. Welcome to the December meeting of the Audio Engineering Society. Tonight we've got Yvonne Tasha talking about the Connect, which is kind of exciting. I read last night online that in the first month it sold 2.5 million units, and the iPad sold 1 million, so 2.5 times more successful than the iPad already. It's probably one of the most successful consumer products ever sold, that kind of rate. So it's exciting to have one of the architects of the device here and look at how it works. And there's people out there that want to learn how to hack it. If you want to know that, you could somehow get you on a little bit tipsy or something. We have a kind of an idea of what we might do next month, just in the way of the January meeting. We're trying to get a guy named Dave Hill to swing through here on his way home from NAMM. Do you know who Dave Hill is? He's a, how would you put it, boutique audio designer. He has a company called Crane Song that makes really interesting signal processing equipment. They just announced a relationship with Avid, and doing stuff for Pro Tools now. And he also designs stuff for some of the other very high-end boutique microphone preamp companies. Very interesting guy. I see him every time I go to Music Messe in Frankfurt, middle of February. He's always wearing leather shorts and Hawaiian shirts out in the winter of Frankfurt, Germany. he's a fun guy. So we hope that's going to happen. It's not solid yet, but that's what we're trying to put together. So stay tuned to our website, and we'll put something fun together for next month. Couple housekeeping things. We need to know how many AES members we have in the room. We don't have Gary here to count, so can I do that, Rick?
10.
10, thank you. And I'm going to count the
rest.
For those of you who are not members, we'd love to have you join our organization. The AES, if you're not familiar with the organization, is a professional society for audio people. All kinds of people, recording engineers, product designers, acoustics researchers, and so on. It's been around for over 60 years now. A lot of the really important audio developments in the history of audio have been sort of nurtured and incubated within the AES, you know, the development of stereophonic sound and the compact disc and MP3 and so on. A lot of that initial research was presented and discussed within the AES. And there's a lot of really interesting people, and I can speak from my own experience. It's been kind of the backbone of my own career, starting companies, raising funding, recruiting employees, getting the message out. AES has always been there supporting me and everything I've done. We have a lot of fun in these meetings too, so I encourage you to consider joining if you're not already a member. Speak to any of us during the break or after the meeting if you're curious about the organization and what it's all about. The website on the our local website is that URL on the sign there. If you just go to aes.org, that's the international website. You can read more about it there too. Let's see. If you didn't sign the little sheet in the back of the room when you came in, you might want to do that. That gets you on our mailing list. It also makes you eligible for the door prizes that go out tonight. And we've got some Microsoft software and some other goodies to give out. And Rick, you wanted to make a plea on behalf of Mr. Kudgel?
Yeah. Midnight Solar, manufacturer of off-the-grid energy management systems, is looking for an engineer type who has embedded systems experience and hopefully DSP experience. So if this is you, or if you know somebody who fits that, get in touch with me, and I'll put you in touch with Bob. Or you can go to the go to Google and look for Midnight Solar. You'll find their startup.
Cool. Also, just keep an eye on our website and the national website for other job openings. One of the things AES does is advertises job openings and helps people out. At this point, we usually go around the room and introduce ourselves. Just a quick, you know, what's your name? What do you do with audio? What's your interest? Just 50 words or less. I'll start. I'm Bob Moses. I'm the chair of the local AS section. I work for a company with a funny name called DAP Corporation, designing semiconductors for audio, and so I'll leave it at that.
Good evening, I'm Ivan Tashin, the speaker tonight. Work here in Microsoft Research, doing audio software, and member of the Pacific Northwest Committee.
My name is Rob Baum. I'm an audio engineer. I work here doing headsets and webcam audio.
Cool. I'm Travis Abel. I'm not a member yet, but I'm into composing and engineering and drumming, so kind of everything all together there.
Trina Sellers, I'm a personal manager for a Joy Marguerite artist, and it's here for some understanding.
I'm Joy Marguerite, I'm a recording artist and a jazz, soul jazz singer and songwriter. I have a production company called Rugal Productions, and I worked in radio as an on-air talent and doing engineering and live engineering for a number of years as well.
Rick Chin, I'm the vice chair of the section, I'm the webmaster, live sound engineer, recording engineer, anything audio, no ladders, no lights, no video.
Ryan Rood, right now, recording engineer and live sound engineer.
Gary Beebe with Broadcast Supply Worldwide in Tacoma, audio sales.
Then I work here at Microsoft Research on acoustic speech signal processor. Associated with Acoustical Society of America. Well, someday I might discuss this, a switch.
I'm Ken Cowan. I recently laid off from a medical device company where I worked for 18 years, and now I'm working at contracting to physio control, and I got an email from Bob Smith, who I haven't met yet, and sounded like an interesting thing because audio has always just been a hobby.
My name is Matt Booty. I work here at Microsoft, the GM of mobile games within Microsoft Game Studios. And before that, about 20 years ago, started out in video games doing audio and DSP for games.
My name is Scott Marins. I work at Motorola. Pretty soon going to be Motorola Mobility, so the cell phone division. We do audio software like Echo Cancellor, audio effects, stuff like that for phones.
My name is Peter Borshaw. I work at Microsoft in the manufacturing test group. Hardware design engineer.
I'm Dan Kingsbury. I work with Peter in manufacturing tests, most recently on Kinect.
Mike Sippo, just a guest here checking it out.
Christopher Overstreet, pianist, composer, and private researcher of gesturally interactive systems, mapping gestures to other types of output media. 3D audio and video lights.
Brian Willoughby, do software and firmware and hardware design. Currently working on a multi-touch controller for controlling audio sound creations.
Steve Wilkins, I work in psychophysical acoustics in a consulting firm. I'm a musician. I have a studio and I have a bunch of stuff in the can if anybody wants weird sound for games.
Greg Duckett, and I'm the Director of R&D Engineering at Rain Corporation. We design and manufacture professional audio equipment up in Mukilteo.
I'm Dan Mortensen. I do live sound for concerts, and I'm on the local committee. And if you want to shake the hand of somebody who worked with Miles Davis and Thelonious Monk and Barbara Streisand, then at the intermission here, you should come up and talk to
Mark Lako.
Steve Turnage, mastering engineer, research board design, former chair.
Lou Cominets, I'm a broadcast video engineer. I do specialize in live multi-camera broadcasts of football games, baseball games, the Olympics. I work for the major networks.
you go talk to Frank during intermission, because he discovered Miles Davis. And it's an amazing group of people that he has. So tonight's guest speaker is Yvonne Tasha. Yvonne has his master's and PhD degree from the University of Sofia, Bulgaria. He works there at Microsoft, Microsoft Research, doing audio and acoustics research. I'm not going to read all this off the webpage here. He was the primary architect of the sound subsystem in the Kinect device. I got to see a demo in his lab about a month ago, and it was really, really cool. The coolest thing is Dr. John Vanderkoy, who's the esteemed editor of the Audio Engineering Society Journal, one of the most revered scientists on the planet, was dancing to some hip hop music. I got a high definition here, so that was a real treat. So thank you, Yvonne, and thank you, Microsoft, for hosting us tonight and giving us this really interesting preview of what's going on in Kinect device.
So good evening. Thanks for coming for this talk. Before even to start, I want to apologize first for my heavy accent. Here in Microsoft, even in Redmond, more than one half of us are not born in the US, so using this broken English is kind of norm. But I have seen some puzzled faces when I spoke with people which are outside of Microsoft. Second thing is that during the talk, you will see a lot of mathematics and equations. If you don't want, just skip them. Try to get the gist of what is going on in the representation of the sound, how computers see it and how they do process the sound. It's not intended to be a heavy digital signal processing course. It's just for those who have seen those mathematics. And then, first couple of words where we are. We're in the building 99 of Microsoft Corporation. This is the headquarter of Microsoft Research, the research wing of this corporation. Microsoft Research was established in 1991. This is the year when the revenue of our company exceeded $1 billion. From all of our sister companies with similar revenue, none of them created their own research organization. None one of them is alive today. We claim here in this building that Microsoft Research, with more than already 850 researchers, creates that stack of technologies which the company needs when it is necessary. We bring to the agility of this company to survive this very fast and very quickly changing world. We don't do here products. We cannot say that, okay, we shipped Windows or Office. What we provide is a pieces of technologies, algorithms, approaches, which help to make Microsoft products better. Instead of to continue and to speak, I will show you a 60 seconds video. So today, we'll talk about the sound. We'll see what we can do to remove the unwanted signals from one single audio channel. What we can do if we have multiple microphones, can we combine them in a proper way to remove the things we don't want? And we'll talk about some basic algorithms which we use, and we'll end up with some applications. And at the end, I'll basically just let the Kinect device with some of the games I brought with me to run and to let you guys to try it. Even at some point somewhere here, we'll have a break And most probably, we will start to do some gaming to have basically to get hold on the technology. Now, sound capturing and processing. So the point we are going to look to this process is kind of different than most of the audio engineers do. For all of them, this is the microphones, and they go and record with the highest possible quality. They have the freedom to have a professional setup when you can put the microphones in a specific way to make the recording to sound better. In computer world, and this computer world includes mobile phones, includes your personal computer at home, your laptop, the Kinect device on anything else in your media room, the speakerphone in your conference room. Usually, first, we don't have the freedom to do the professional setup of the microphones, and this requires a heavy processing of the audio signal so we can remove the noises, reverberation, etc., etc., and get some acceptable sound quality. And because in engineering, Nautic is free, this processing itself introduces some certain distortions in the audio signal. So it's always a question of balance. More processing, we get rid of more of the unwanted signal and introduce certain processing. But in general, sound capturing and processing from this point of view has all of those three categories. It's a science. We work with mathematical models, with statistical parameters of the signals. There is a heavy mathematics involved in deriving those equations. And we have repeatable results, means the same input always generates the same output. So this is all science of science. But at the end, the consumer of this processed sound is the human with its own ear and its own brain. And once we go to the human perception, this is already an art. Because it's very difficult to explain in equations what humans will or will not like after we do some heavy processing. And of course, it's a craft. As most of the audio capturing and audio recording, you always have some tricks and some stuff which you put in your processing algorithms in a way that it sounds a little bit better than the same algorithm from the computing lab. Okay, so in computing, we have mostly two major consumers of this captured sound. First is the telecommunications. Starting from the mobile phone, desktop PCs, we run software like Skype, like Microsoft Office Communicator, Windows Live Messenger, Google Chat, you name it. And the second is speech recognition. This is something very specific for the computer world, but already speech recognition is an important component of the interfaces between the human and the machine. And it has its own specifics, which we're not going to go deep here today. So, in general, the discussing of those basic algorithms is pretty much the meat of the talk today. And we'll just show some aspects of building the end-to-end system. But the principle here is that a chain of optimal blocks, each one of them is optical in certain sense, is usually not optimal. Not is a suboptimal, so you have to tweak and tune those blocks together in a line as they are connected and do the processing. So let's talk about the sound and the sound capturing devices. From a physical point of view, the sound is nothing else but moving compressions and rarefications of the air. They usually move straight, and the sound has several characteristics. The first is the wavelength, the distance between, the closest distance between two points with equal pressure. And it has its own frequency. If we stay here, how many of those will go through that point for 1 second? Then, based on those two important properties, frequency and wavelength, which are connected with a constant called speed of sound, and in the air it's 342 meters per second at 20 centigrades. This speed of sound is pretty much volatile with almost anything in the air. you change the atmospheric pressure, the speed of sound changes. You change the temperature, the speed of sound changes. You change the proportion in some of the gases in the atmosphere, the speed of sound changes. So it varies, and it goes down to 330 meters per second at the freezing point at 0 centigrades. But as every single wave, we have those parameters. So intensity is how much the atmospheric pressure changes. And usually it is measured in logarithmic scale, so we have to have 0 dB, a reference. And the reference is selected to be 10^-12 watts per square meter. This is the amount of energy we have from 1 square meter is 10^-12 watts. If you expose and show 1 square meter on sunlight, you get around 500 to 1,000 watts. So the first conclusion here is that sound is extremely, extremely low energy phenomenon. Second, usually if you count the intensity as the power which goes through a given surface, we can use the sound pressure level, which is measured directly in changes of the atmospheric and of the pressure in the atmosphere. And again, because it's logarithmic scale, 20 micropascals pressure is selected as a reference. This is the threshold of hearing of a human ear, around 1,000 hertz. So 0 dB is a sound at 1,000 hertz, which we can barely hear. We're not going to discuss any aspects of human psychology, psychoacoustics, and how humans perceive the sound. That's a pretty much deserves a separate talk, but this is just to measure the reference here. So propagation of the sound across the air is not free. We have energy losses. Of course, first with the distance, because we have the same area, but sound basically goes in radius. So if we increase the distance twice, you'll have 2 times smaller energy through the same amount, through the same surface. And that's the famous 1/R² law. Besides this, the compression and ratification is related to losses because of the shrinking and expansion of the air molecules. And this is pretty much the losses of the attenuation of the sound as a function of the frequency in decibels per meter. And what we can see here is that in up to 20,000 hertz, which is how much we can hear, it's negligible. For 1 meter, it's 0.6 dB. And once we go 1 meter further, we lose 6 dB because of the distance. So this is why in most of the mathematical estimations, we consider that the sound propagates in the atmosphere without losses. This is valid for this room. This is not valid if you try to do a sound propagation on a couple of miles by some other reasons. But for most of the normal conditions when we use a sound as an information medium, that's true. And just a couple of words about another specific for the sound phenomena. This is that the sound, besides being a very low energy phenomenon, it's a very wide band phenomenon. So humans are considered that they can hear between 20 and 20,000 hertz. This is 1,000 times difference in the frequency. For your information, the visible light, the low frequency red signals have a wavelength around 340 nanometers. And the bright blue close to ultraviolet is 720, which means all the colors we can see actually capture less than 2 times difference in the wavelength. And on the other hand, in the sound, we have 1,000 times difference in frequencies. And there is one more thing. The wavelength of the visible light is measured in nanometers. This is 10 on minus 9th, which means that every single object around is way, way, way bigger than the wavelength. So the sound propagates in straight lines. We have a perfect shadows. You can see my shadow. And this is definitely not the case for the audio. The audio, the surrounding us objects are comparable with that wavelength. 1 hertz is 3.4 meters. 1,000 hertz is 30 centimeters. 10,000 hertz is 3 centimeters. This is this big. So not only we have objects which are comparable with the wavelength, but together, simultaneously, in the same sound we use, we'll see pretty much a sound which behaves like a visible light. For 10,000 hertz, this thing will have a clear shadow, and 10,000 hertz sound source will not be hearable here. On the other hand, 100 hertz will go around this desk without any problems. So we face all of those the diffraction and interferential effects during the emitting of the same sound, because our environment has size of the objects which are comparable to the wavelength, and in some cases you will have a pretty much occlusion as with the light, and in some cases they are acoustically transparent. And of course you can see how much bandwidth can the interval of frequencies different animals can hear. So human hearing is between 20 and 20,000. And you can see that we are actually pretty good listeners. Better than us are common house spider, I think, is what is missing here. Interesting case is right here. The bat, which can hear between 1,000 and 10,000 hertz, but can send a chirp signals at 40, 45,000 hertz. And this is how the animal basically can do the location and detection of the objects in front of it. And the other case is the whales. They can do this, and they have this huge diapason in water. They have way, way worse hearing in air. And the reason for this is that it is very difficult to match the acoustical impedance of the air and the water. And just for information, what means how loud is the sound? So 0 dB is the threshold of hearing. You drop a pin, it's around 10 dB. In a quiet library, you have around 40 dB. That's a very quiet sound. Here, our sound pressure level, when I do not speak, is around 50 dB SPL, and it goes higher and higher to heavy machinery shop, which is around 100 dB. This is close to the threshold of pain, and it's extremely unhealthy, and it goes up to 170 dB for the space shuttle launch pad. This is for the set of frequencies we can hear. Otherwise, for those which we cannot, let's say low frequencies, I just can give you an example. A passing cloud above us generates a sound with 170 to 190 dB SPL. But the frequency is way, way below. 1 hertz is more changes in the atmospheric pressure. And it's a subject of meteorology, not subject of acoustics. So, how are we going to get the sound, those microscopic changes in the pressure, in the atmospheric pressure, and convert it to an electrical signal? So those are the microphones. All of the microphones use some physical effects to convert small movements of a diaphragm back and forth into electrical signal. This can be a crystal, which is based on the piezoelectric effect. We have a small piezo crystal connected to the diaphragm. Diaphragm moves back and forth because of the changes of the atmospheric pressure, and we have electrical signal. This can be a dynamic, which is pretty much inverted loudspeaker. You have a magnet, and you have a coil which moves inside, driven by the diaphragm, and condenser, which is pretty much two plates, and one of them moves, and this is changes the capacity, and somehow we convert this into an electrical signal. So we're not going to go in details how the movements of the diaphragm are converted to an electrical signal, but what matters here is actually that we have to have this diaphragm. So pretty much the microphone is nothing else but a closed capsule with a diaphragm. Closed capsule means the pressure here is constant, and when it changes on the outer side, the diaphragm starts to bend back and forth. And if the size of this microphone is smaller than the wavelength of the sound we want to capture, then we can say that we capture the atmospheric changes in the atmospheric pressure in a point in the space. So this is acoustical monopole. On top of this, this microphone pretty much reacts on the sound in the same way regardless from the direction it came from, because those are changes in the atmospheric pressure. Completely different case we have if we have a small pipe and the diaphragm in the middle. So this is called acoustical dipole and has a very specific behavior when the sound comes from different direction. So if we have a sound coming from 90 degrees, the sound wave, the changes in the pressure came here, and we have the same pressure of both sides of the diaphragm. It doesn't move. If the sound came from the axis of this pipe, first it will hit the front, and with some small delay, it will hit the back. This means that we will have a difference, and it will react. So this is why the directivity pattern of this dipole is figure 8. At 90 degrees, plus minus, we don't have sensitivity. Even if we have a loud sound, it is not registered. But if it comes from across the axis of the microphone, we have a pretty decent sensitivity. Unfortunately, because this microphone doesn't do anything else but snapshot and measures the difference in the atmospheric pressure here and here. So pretty much it does the first derivative of the atmospheric pressure. As a result, we have a not very pleasant frequency response. If the signal is set with a very low frequency, pretty much the same thing happens on both sides, and our microphone is not quite sensitive. Once we start to have a higher frequency, then the sensitivity goes up. But still, this pressure gradient microphone is an important component of the microphones. And so far we assumed that the microphone is in a so-called far-field sound field, which means the sound is somewhere very, very far, and the magnitudes on both sides of the microphone are the same. If we have a sound source which is closer, what happens is that we have a certain sound path here, and the sound has to travel this distance, which means that we have already a comparable difference in the sound pressure level here and here just because of the difference of the sound paths. And then the microphone starts to behave a little bit different. Now, of course, we don't want that 6 dB per octave slope towards the higher frequencies, so we have to compensate somehow. And in a simple way, we can compensate by adding one single RC group, which has the opposite frequency response, so we can have a flat frequency response. And if we compensate for far field, as you can see in pretty much the entire range, we'll get our flat frequency response. So let me reiterate this. If you return back here, This frequency response compensated with a one RC group, we can flatten it. And then for far field sounds, we'll have the green line here. But then when we have a sound source which is closer, so we grab the microphone from, let's say, from this distance and I start to approach it, then the effect of the different difference will actually this. This is not me. Anyway, so it will basically have the effect that we did an overcompensation. And the buses.
It could be somebody outside wanting
it. It doesn't matter. So what happens that for closer distance, let's say this near is 2 centimeters, the microphone is a closed talk microphone, we'll have overcompensation. Okay, if we have compensated for a microphone which is close to our mouth, means to strengthen this line, then for far field sounds, we'll have buses basically going down. What we call this? So what happens when you hold a microphone, which is usually estimated singers, which is usually estimated for 20 centimeters, 30 centimeters, and they do this, and you see how buses go, basically enforce it, and you hear way, way different voice. Or if you have a microphone, directional microphone on your closed talk, right here, and suddenly all the sounds, especially in the lower part where the noises are, start to disappear. So this is called noise canceling microphone. It's nothing else but properly compensated figure eight microphone. And I think this is called presence effect. When somebody, and actually singers heavily use this, by changing the distance of the microphone, they actually, what happens is they move the frequency response up and down. It's kind of a on the fly control of the buses. Okay. So those are how the microphones look inside. This is not a microphone. This is microphone capsule inside and enclosure. And inside, usually, we have something like this. Those are omnidirectional microphone. The capsule, close it with the diaphragm in front. You can see some small holes there, but this is just to compensate for the changes of the atmospheric pressure. And the directional microphones already have well visible holes on the back. So it's a kind of a small pipe, and with a diaphragm in front. In general, combination between the directivity pattern of an omnidirectional microphone and figure eight microphone in certain proportion, that's alpha thing, which is between 0 and 1, can bring us to a large variety of directivity patterns of the microphones. And this is when we have our cardioid, supercardioid, hypercardioid, and figure eight microphone. So if this alpha thing, which is how much omnidirectional microphone portion of the omnidirectional microphone we have is equal to 0. Let me return back to show you the equation. So we're talking about this alpha. If this alpha is 1, the directivity pattern is constant. This is omnidirectional microphone. If this alpha goes down to 0, this is 0. This here, we just have a cosine of the angle. This is figure 8 directivity pattern. And something in between, we can reach those different directivity patterns. Each one of them has a name because of a certain specific property. Omnidirectional microphone is well known because it captures the sound from everywhere. The cardioid microphone, is known that it completely suppresses the sounds coming from the opposite direction. Supercardioid microphone has the highest front-back ratio, means the sensitivity, the energy which captures from this half is compared to the energy which captures from the front half is highest. This makes it a very good microphone to be placed on the edge of the theatrical scene to capture the artists and not the coughing of the public. The hypercardioid microphone is known that it has a highest directivity ratio, means suppresses maximum amount of noise coming from all directions. And used to be times when actually those directional microphones, we had two actual microphones in the enclosure, and you get the two signals, and you have a small port, and you can actually on the fly change the directivity pattern of the microphones. That's long, long time ago. Currently, we just have capsules which have a specific directivity pattern. Of course, those were theoretical derivations of the directivity patterns. Once we start to deal with real microphones, we start to see some different things. For example, this is a copy of directivity pattern of one of the microphone, directivity microphone, cardioid microphone. And you see the manufacturer says, okay, it's flat. And down to around 300 hertz, the slide starts to go down. At 180 degrees, we have pretty much 15 dB suppression. So the cardioid microphone doesn't go to zero on the back, but 15 dB is pretty decent, actually, directivity. When we get this microphone and actually measure it in an echoic chamber, what happens is that first we see that it's not kind of equal. For certain frequencies, it has a tail, so it's a hypercardioid. For certain, it's a pure cardioid, etc., etc. So they're not uniform across the frequencies. And at 0 degree, the frequency response is not quite flat. We have 3 to 3 dB going up and down. But regardless of this, this is a relatively good match between what the specification says and what the actual microphone measured in an echoic chamber shows as parameters. And everything we discussed so far was about having a microphone freely hanging in the air, because we can say that those two are hanging in the air. The stand is very small compared to the wavelength we want to capture. Unfortunately, this is not the case when we have a microphones in a devices. Telephones, speakerphone, microphone, like a Kinect device, then the things get complex. And the first thing which happens is that we already start to see quite a symmetric directivity pattern. What you actually see is the directivity pattern of one of the four microphones we have in the Kinect device. Usually, having a microphone around, you place it in an enclosure, makes the directivity patterns worse. The directivity index, how much noise we can suppress, is going down. Kinect is one very pleasant exception, because in the design of the mic and the position, the placement of the microphones, we actually use it, the shape of the enclosure, to form the directivity patterns of the microphones and actually increase the directivity, the index, increase the directivity of the microphones, so we can basically suppress more noise in advance, even before we start to do any digital signal processing. Okay. But in general, to make a simple short summary, a cardioid microphone has 4.8 dB noise reduction compared with a single omnidirectional microphone. So we are already 4.8 dB ahead in suppressing noises and removing the unwanted signals. So it's highly recommended to use directional microphones if we know and can basically guess where the speaker, where the sound source is coming from. In the devices like Natal, it's very obvious because they are in front, and we do not expect them to have sound sources behind. And if they are, we actually don't want them. Those are usually reflections from the wall behind. So this is why all four microphones in Kinect point straight forward and try to suppress the noises coming from left, right, and back. There's the speakers, there are reflections, we don't want them. Okay. Now, we're ready. Our sound is already electrical signals converted from the microphone. Now let's see what we are dealing with. We'll talk about the noises and the speech signal. We'll see how computers actually see the sound. First, noise. What's noise? Let me play some noise. This unpleasant noise is called white noise because it covers evenly all frequencies, which we can hear from 20 to 20,000 hertz. It is mathematical abstraction. We cannot see this in the nature. In the nature, you can see this. This is inside of passenger plane, a noisy place in general. But this noise has a different sound because it has a lot of more low frequencies and the frequencies towards the upper part go down. And of course, we can have another unpleasant noise, which contains many, 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 many humans talking together. Besides the spectrum, the frequencies those noises contain, actually, statistically speaking, they are quite similar. All of them can be described, the magnitudes can be described with a Gaussian distribution, which means that this is the simplest statistical model, and you can start and play with them. Of course, the white noise has a flat frequency, flat spectrum, while the other noises pretty much go down towards the high frequencies and have a higher magnitude towards the lower part of the spectrum. So, skip this. Speech. Speech happened to be different by many, many, many different aspects. It has nothing to do and it is not like the noise. The first thing is that if you try to do a statistical model of the distribution of the magnitudes, we don't see this to look like a Gaussian distribution. This is the blue line. It's way peakier, so the speech stays mostly around the zero and goes with a sharp, basically, big magnitudes. So Gaussian is not quite a good statistical model. On top of this, the speech signal has parts with completely different statistical parameters. We see vowels, and those, as we will see, has a very good harmonic structure. And we have unvoiced fricatives, which is sh, ps, and those are kind of noise-like. And speech is not constant as the noise, but usually it has a pauses as integral part of the speech signal. It is chopped on parts with a different, completely different parameters. And unlike the noise, which usually, after some reverberation here or there, is kind of spread, especially the speech source is usually a point source, which we can point, okay, it came from there. Oh, on top of this, so we discussed that it is not kind of Gaussian. And those are three representations of three different speech signals. First, let me just comment what this means. This is time in seconds, and this is frequency. Up is zero, down is 8,000 hertz. And this is the scale, the magnitude. Reddish color means higher magnitude. So what we can say that when you say shh, what we see that we have mostly energies around 3, 4, 5,000 hertz it is not much down and it is not much below 1000 hertz. On the other hand, if you say it's kind of an implosive impulse signal, we have a frequency and some energy here, and the rest is pretty much with low magnitude. And the last is, this is just a vowel. What we can see is that this signal has a very good harmonic structure. It has a main frequency, which is called pitch. This is the speed of vibration of our vocal cords. So then this basic signal, and they vibrate kind of like a hammer basically hitting a surface, which means besides the main frequency, we have all harmonic second, 2 times, 3 times, 4 times, 5 times, up to 20 times in frequency. And then this basically chain of impulses goes through our mouth, which with muscles we change the shape and form this envelope. And those maximums in the envelope are called Forman frequencies. So from now, what we can say is that, okay, we have a maximum around 600 hertz here and a maximum around 2000 hertz here. Take a generator of those pulses, make this shape, play to a speaker, and you'll hear because based on those Forman frequencies, we recognize which vowel is pronounced. Humans have a different pitch. Usually males, they have a lower pitch. Females, they have a higher pitch. But this shape, the Forman frequencies are the same, and this is why A is A, regardless of who is saying it. Okay. So what we can do with the speech signal? We can do noise suppression. Why? Because we saw that speech signal is kind of quite different than the speaks, than the noise signal. So there is a way to distinguish them and to suppress the noise. Noise cancellation is something different. Noise cancellation is removing a noise we know. Classic example is in the car, we place a second microphone in the engine compartment. And this is the noise of the engine. We can try to find how much of it goes to the microphone which stays in front of the driver and to subtract it. So this is noise cancellation. More common actually is those noise cancellation headphones in the planes when we have a small microphones on the outer side of the air cups. So we can estimate how much of the plane noise came inside the cups and subtract it. In general, all of those class of processing algorithms which we use to make humans to perceive the signals better is called speech enhancement. And one more processing which we are not going to talk about is active noise cancellation. So this is what happens in those noise cancelling headsets. Nothing can stop us to, we have a lot of loudspeakers here. And if you have some low frequency noise going around, to make the loudspeakers to send opposite signal to the noise, this low frequency noise, and suddenly we can have a quieter room. That works to certain frequency range, and it's kind of tricky, but it can be used. So we're going to talk mostly about speech enhancement, and we're not going to touch noise canceling headphones. We're not going to talk about removing the noise from let's say, from this room. So once the changes in the atmospheric pressure became electrical signal, the first process which happens with them is so-called discretization. Computers, they work with numbers. And this simply means, ignoring this whole math here, is that we're going to sample to measure the magnitude of the signal with certain on certain intervals. And those intervals is called are called basically sampling period. Or inverted, this gives us the sampling frequency. And there are several people who left their names, but one of the most famous is Claude Shannon, who basically said that we should do this sampling with at least 2 times higher frequency than the highest frequency in the signal we want to sample. So technically, this means that for humans which can hear up to 20 kilohertz, we should do this with 40 kilohertz sampling rate. The standard is 44.1 kilohertz, and this is what we use in most of the recording equipment, at least. Professional equipment goes to 48. We have 129 already. In computers, in the telephony, we actually go down because more frequently sampling the signal means more numbers to crunch and to process, and because the speech signal goes up to 6-7 kilohertz, usually 16 kilohertz sampling rate is considered that that's enough for speech signal, for speech communication. Okay. Second major thing which happens with the speech signal once it is sampled is quantization. So we get our number, the value of the atmospheric pressure or the voltage, but that thing is basically has to be converted to a number. And the numbers in computers tend to be discrete. So it can be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, but nothing in between. And this is why this is process of quantization is converting the analog signal, analog value, to a discrete value. And from the moment we did the sampling and quantization, we now have a stream of numbers. Pretty much this is what computers work with. We have those numbers with certain frequency which arrive with reduced precision because of the quantization, and we don't know what happens in between, but the sampling theorem of Claude-Shannon tells us that it is okay because we did the sampling with at least 2 times higher frequency than the highest frequency we're interested of. Now, next thing, computers also kind of don't deal quite well with stream of numbers. So what happens is, next thing, we chop those numbers in packets. Those packets are called audio frames. And the size of audio frames is between 80 and 1,000 samples, which means usually typically between 5 and 25 milliseconds. So we take this piece and then we try to process it together. Next thing which happens is that this processing happens in so-called frequency domain. We change the representation of the signals. If you take 1024 samples, as we sampled them from the microphone, this is a function of the time. If you use so-called Fourier transformation, we'll get again 1024 samples, but they represent the signal in frequency domain. So for this particular frame, we know which frequencies we have, higher magnitude or lower magnitude. And because this signal goes as a stream, what actually happens is those frames are 50% overlapped. You can see here, this is one frame. We convert it to frequency domain, do whatever we want here. This is the output, and then it is converted back to time domain. But next frame is 50% moving forward. And then they are properly weighted so we can combine them in a way that this signal has no breaks and is kind of properly aligned. So from now on, everything what happens, and we'll be discussing what happens here. Our input for our algorithms is one vector of 256 or 1024 samples in frequency domain, the spectrum of the signal, and then we do some stuff here, and then the rest is this all so-called overlap and add process. This is pretty much the standard audio framework for all audio processing algorithms. Okay. Now, what we can do and how we can remove the noise. I'll try to increase the speed here because we will see a lot of equations. But roughly, what happens is that we get this vector y, which is the representation of in frequency domain of the current audio frame. And that's a mixture between speech signal and noise signal. So what we can do is, if we know how much noise we have, let's say we get a signal and we know it's a 15% noise. If we can apply a number multiplied by 0.85, presumably we will have just the speech signal left. And if you can do this for each frequency bin, K here is a frequency bin, this real gain, which will be different for every single frame. But if we can somehow compute this thing, then the output will have less noise because at least we remove the equal portion of the energy. So, pretty much this is what happens. We will heavily use the fact that the speech is with pauses in between. And we will use a block called voice activity detector. When the voice activity detector tells us there is no speech, it's just noise, we'll update the noise model. This is our statistical parameter, one per frequency bin, which simply tells us the noise energy for this particular frequency. And when, pretty much on every single frame, we'll try to compute this suppression rule, which is that number, usually lower than one, which we can apply and then convert back to time domain. So this is pretty much what a noise suppressor does. So we're going to skip here a substantial math here, but pretty much one suppression rule is kind of complex and it's not a function just of the current noise, it's a function of the prior and posterior signal to noise ratio. It is something which a lot of smart people work at for a long time, but this is already considered a classic digital signal processing algorithm. And one noise suppressor, okay, we skip this, and one noise suppressor is something which is already not considered as something we should spend time on, or just take that algorithm, use it, and it actually improves a lot. The signals on the output of the noise suppressor sound nice. The noise is gone. I'll have to underline here that this is not a miracle. If you do a very serious testing about understandability, means you have a signal plus speech signal plus noise, and ask people to do transcription, and then you do a state-of-the-art noise suppression, and ask another group of people to do transcription, the percentage of the errors will be pretty much the same. Nothing can beat 100 billion neurons between our 2 ears. Okay? But the difference is that those who listen to the noise suppressed processed algorithm perceive it as better because they load less the brain. So it's reduces the fatigue, and in general, is considered more friendly to the speaker. Instead of we to spend our brain power to remove the noise, the computer does for us.
So, what technique of noise suppression did you do for Connect?
We'll see a block diagram, partial block diagram, what happens. But yes, we have a noise suppressor at some point after the so-called microphone array. So now, microphone arrays, what they do? Usually, I try to compare the sound processing from a single microphone as trying to do image processing or to make a picture with a camera which has one pixel. This is pretty much it. We have in sample a pretty complex three-dimensional propagation of the sound wave in one single point. We don't know where the signal came from. If we place more than one microphone in a certain mutual position, which we know, then we can do more interesting stuff. And this is called microphone array. We'll see that multiple microphones became microphone array when we do the processing and try to combine the signals together. This is not a microphone array. This is a stereo microphone. We don't do any processing. We take the two signals and Rick records them. That's it. We leave the brain to do the processing. Let's see what we can do with the microphone arrays. So you see, if we have here multiple microphones. In this case, we have four. Here we have eight in a circular geometry. They can be placed into a car. We have four microphones here. And having those multiple microphones allows us to sense where the sound came from. Why? Very simple. Here is the microphone array. The sound came from here. It will reach first one of the microphones, then second, then third, then the fourth. If the sound came from here, the order will be opposite. The sound moves enough slow from computer standpoint. This is well detectable. The difference between here and here is 7-8 samples at 16 kilohertz sampling rate, which allows us to have a pretty decent sense where is the sound came from. Next thing is to know which direction we want to capture. Once we know this, what we can do is the following. For example, if I want to capture Rob's voice, I know the delays. The sound coming from Rob's direction. And then what I can do is, with the processing phase, to delay this signal in a way to be aligned to the last one. The second microphone to the last one, the third microphone to the last one. Once I sum those signals, all signals coming from Rob's direction are in phase and will have a constructive interference. However, if we have a sound coming from this direction, even after this shifting, the signals are with different phase and will have a destructive interference and their level will go down. So suddenly, with this simple delay and some processing, I started to have a better directivity towards this direction and started to suppress the sounds coming from other directions. And because, if you can remember, this noise was kind of spread around us, but usually the speaker is point source, then this is important property. I will point the beam towards Rob, will suppress the other signals which are mostly noise, or Rob's voice reflected from the ceiling and from the walls, which is reverberation and something we don't like as well. And I'll have a better signal on the output of this microphone array. So this very simple algorithm, as you can see, has not quite good directivity pattern. This is direction, and this is frequency. For low frequencies, I have pretty much no directivity. Yes, towards the desired direction, I have a flat frequency response. I'll capture his voice nice and clear. But for certain frequencies, I'll have some areas with higher sensitivity. But in general, it's a higher directivity microphone. Nothing more, nothing less. And now I will show you this in action in a quick demo. Okay, 1, 2, 3, testing. So you can see that the device can sense where I'm talking. 1, 2, 3, testing. You see the red line is a block called sound source localizer, which localizes where is the point source and tries to listen towards that direction, suppressing the noises coming from other directions. 1, 2, 3, testing. 1, 2, 3, you can see. 1, 2, 3, testing. And we can do something like this. Okay, 1, 2, 3, testing. So I'm, let's say, 3-4 meters away from the device. 1, 2, 3, testing. 1, 2, 3, testing. 1, 2, 3, testing.
Okay, 1, 2, 3, testing. So I'm, let's say,
So what is the effect? It shortens the distance. If I have a higher directivity, I'll capture less noise and less reverberation. And from 4 meters, I'll sound in the same way as I'm at 1 meter distance using a regular just one microphone. That's pretty much it. Reduces the noise, reduces the reverberation, and shortens the distance, the perceivable distance between the speaker and the microphone. Technically, this means better quality, because closer to the microphone in general means less noise and less reverberation. One more. Let me see how this will work. So what is going to happen here is I'm going to record in parallel. Okay, so first I'll mute the microphones, the PA. And then I'll try to record in parallel. A signal from one microphone, which is on my laptop, and with the microphone array. And you'll see the difference. 1, 2, 3, testing, testing, testing. This is the single microphone in front of me.
1, 2, 3, testing, testing, testing.
And this is the output of the microphone array. So first, you see the noise floor is gone. Second, I'll play this again, but you can hear how hollow, more reverberant is the signal here. And this sounds like I'm closer. And the distance was absolutely the same. Let's hear this again.
1, 2, 3, testing, testing, testing. One, two, three, testing, testing, testing.
And if you look at the measured signal to noise ratio here, we started at 14 dB signal to noise ratio. This is measured on one of the microphones. And on the output, we had 36 dB signal to noise ratio, or we did an impressive 22 dB suppression of the noise without hurting actually much the voice signal.
Now, was there any problem with the low end or anything? I mean, it sounded great.
So under low end, if you mean the lower part of the frequency band, yes. This size of microphone array is not quite efficient for 100 hertz. For speech, we actually care about from 200 to 7,000 is pretty much sufficient for anything, for telecommunication, for speech recognition. So this is pretty much a low. Below 200 hertz, just cut it. Don't process it. Don't waste CPU time. Just remove it.
Would it have to be twice as big to go to 100 hertz?
Yes.
Okay.
So technically, if you go into the research labs which do audio research, you will see 20 to 36 element microphone arrays, 3-4 meters long, etc., etc. But Microsoft Research is a part of a research of a commercial company. And yes, we do basic research. We enjoy those algorithms. But when the time came to do some prototyping, always ask ourselves, if we ever want to make this a product, is this size reasonable or we should stick with something smaller? Okay. Where were we? So, just a couple of terminology here about the microphone arrays. So, this process of combining the signals from the four microphones is called beamforming because it forms, you saw the green line, forms kind of a listening beam towards given direction. The algorithm I describe at delay and sum is the simplest, the most intuitive, and of course, the least efficient algorithm. By changing the way we mix those four signals, we actually can make the microphone array to listen to different directions without any moving parts. It's the same as the sound operator which holds these big directional microphones during making movies and moves it from sound source to sound source, so we can make the microphone array to make this automatically. So this process of changing the beam, the listening point, is called beam steering. We can do even more. We can do so-called no-forming, which means I want to capture you, but I don't want to capture Rob, which talks in parallel, so I can tell the microphone that he mixed the microphones in a way to have a pole towards this direction and null towards this direction, so all the direct path from Rob's voice will be suppressed. Of course, there will be some reverberation in the room, and I'll capture a portion of it, but most of the energy will be gone. And of course, we can do the same thing with no steering. For example, I want to capture your voice, but Rob's is talking and moving back and forth. I can steer that null to suppress him constantly. And of course, sound source localization is an important part of every single microphone array processing, because before to point the beam, we have to know the direction. So we have the ability with this microphone, with any microphone array, to detect where the sound came from. And actually quite precise. We're talking about a couple of degrees here. At 4 meters, my mouth has 3 degrees size. So pretty much I can pinpoint the beam to the mouth of the speaker.
So you could take that into that New York cafe and hone in on somebody's conversation. And you could record all 4 channels and do it later on, however you want it, right?
That will be more difficult to do it 4 channels, but let's say that we can design a microphone array which can do this even. I think yesterday somebody sent a link of a gigantic microphone array on top of the basketball field with 512 microphones. And after this, you can go and listen what the coach tells the players. You can listen to some conversations between the attendees of the game, and that can happen quite well.
It takes a lot more microphones to do that well.
Yes. Because the distance... Yeah, but this is the distance is up to 3-4 meters above. Beyond that, the reverberation already is too much. And you need a larger array and more microphones and more processing power.
You need a minimum of 4 microphones to make this work, or can it be done?
Yes. Trust me, if you can do it with 3, we do it. Every cent is counted in the cost of goods on the device. Okay. Just, we see 2 types of beamformers. One of them is called time-invariant beamformer. This means those mixing coefficients for each frequency beam for each channel we pre-compute offline for beams every 5 degrees, store them into the computer memory, and then when the sound source localizer tells us 42.3 degrees, we take the weights or the coefficients for the beam at 40 degrees, and because 5 degrees are kind of the beam width, we can pretty much cover the entire space without doing any computation, serious computation, in real time. This works if you assume that the noise is isotropic, spread around us with equal probability from each direction, and we cannot do this on the fly, null steering, and when we have a disturbing sound source. Adaptive beamforming. Actually, I will return a little bit to the slide. So after a lot of math, we came up with this formula for the weights, the mixing coefficients. The adaptive beamformer, it's absolutely the same. The only difference is that those noise models are updated on the fly. At every single frame, we recompute the best mixing matrix. And this is why when we have somebody talking, we want to capture. There is another person which talks and we don't want to capture. After less than a second, our directivity pattern suddenly changes. You see here, we have a desired sound source. It's all red in the directivity pattern. And we have somebody who is talking and we don't want. And the computer actually senses that, okay, there is some sound source we want to suppress and apply it, and this is typical application of convergent adaptive beamform, which places a null towards the undesired direction and have a pole towards the desired direction. So we have four microphones, and means we can satisfy four conditions. The first is towards the listening direction, we want unit gain and zero phase shift. So we have three other conditions to play with. If we have a second sound source, we can have another null. If we have a lot of sound sources, we'll need a lot of microphones. This explains why we need 512 microphones for that basketball field. Okay, and one more, just I'll do a quick demo. We can go a little bit further, and you can do localization for the sound for each frequency bin and do some additional beyond just the linear beamforming, which is just summing of the microphone array signals from the microphones weighted in a certain degree. And what we can do is we can apply a weight. So this is kind of a special suppression. And this is a simple illustration. We have a human speaker here and a radio talking here. This is frequency. And of course, a lot of noise. So just for the sake of the experiment, what I did is said, okay, everything which is plus minus 20 degrees goes through. Everything beyond this, put again zero. We don't need those signals. And this is what we have in the output. So the radio is gone completely. We have two sound signals in the same frequency band, and the only difference is that they came from different directions. Using the microphone array, we can separate and suppress those which we don't want. Her voice sounded slightly distorted. And I, again, want to repeat, the filter was just like this. We have way more sophisticated statistical methods to introduce as less distortion as possible, and still to suppress whatever we don't want. So pretty much this is what we just saw as a function of the time, and this is direction. This is the radio here, and this is her voice. You see that we have enough resolution to let this go through and to suppress this. In the terms of directivity index, the blue line is just the beamformer, and you can see that this special filtering actually gave us around 15-20 dB better directivity index. It's time for 15 minutes break. Go around, and by the way, I will switch to the Kinect device so we can use the break to play some games. I brought actually a real Xbox with real games. And in the second part, we'll continue to see how this thing works. Enjoy meantime the device. Do some socializing. After 15 minutes, you'll get again together. There'll be a raffle to see who is going to get the prize, the door prizes here. In short, 15 minutes break, people.